welcome to Hazel and Katniss and Harry and Star, a young adult literature podcast, their film and television adaptations, and everything in between. I'm Joe.
And I'm Brenna.
And our show is located on the ancestral lands of the Haudenosaunee, the Huron-Wendat, and the Anishinaabe on lands connected to the Toronto Purchase, Treaty 13 of 1805.
And on the Tecumloops-Tay-Sequim territory within the unceded traditional lands of Sequim Ulu. And today's text, The Spiderwick Chronicles, is set in the state of Maine in the U.S., and this is the traditional home of the Wabanaki, Abenaki, and Penobscot nations. Joe, I am surprised by how much I enjoyed this series, I have to say.
Okay.
Yeah. So we read all five, like the first five books of the series, which is the five books that make up the Spiderwick Chronicles. There's like another series that comes after that and some companion books, but we focused on the first five. Mm-hmm. And Joe, they're very charming.
Yeah. You and I were having offline conversations about this where it feels almost British, even though it is very distinctively set in America.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's something about the like children adventure story that does that for me for some reason. Mm-hmm. And I think too, obviously, this is a supernatural story. For those who aren't familiar, it's about a group of kids who discover that they are kind of living amongst a world of fairies that obviously before they moved to this ramshackle old house, they had no reason to know existed. And I don't know, there's something about like fairies and gnomes and hobgoblins that immediately takes me to the UK.
Yeah. So we should note that this book series is written by Tony D. Terlizzi as well as Holly Black.
Yeah. And I knew Holly Black's name in YA, but I feel like I know it from, I don't know, like big sort of sweeping YA fantasy romance, maybe? I'm not sure why that's in my head for her, but like these are very middle grade or even maybe a little bit younger. I think the movie skews a little older because there are moments that are quite scary. The books skew a little younger because they're quite gentle.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is like, this is definitely solidly a children's series.
Yeah. Okay, well, why don't you try to walk us through what happens across these five shortish books?
Yeah, okay, I'll do my best to not, like, get too leggy here, Joe. So our main characters are Jared, Simon, and Mallory. They're siblings, and we really focus primarily on Jared's point of view. These siblings are moving to Maine after a big change in the family fortunes. Their dad has left the family, and their mom is low on resources, and there's this big old ramshackle mansion in the family because Aunt Lucinda has had to go into a care home, and the house is available, and so they move in. But like, there's huge chunks of the house that you can't use because it's like rotting out from under itself. Yeah. And so it's important to note that Jared has been having trouble adjusting to life without his dad. So he's been getting into trouble at school. He probably would have been expelled from his school if they weren't moving anyway. It's been a rough time for Jared. He has a twin brother named Simon and an older sister named Mallory, and they are both way more sort of stable from the perspective of the mom.
Jared's the troublemaker, so if anything goes wrong, he's going to be the one who gets blamed. And then Simon is studious and kind of, he doesn't want to get involved with anything if he doesn't have to. And then Mallory is a little bit older and she's very into fencing, but she often ends up having to act like a bit of a surrogate mom.
Yeah, I was going to say, she's very much the mom cipher. Simon is obsessed with animals and, yeah, as Joe says, would rather keep to himself. So the problem is that, of course, when they move into this house that is basically run by a brownie named Thimbletack, who is pretty angry with the family. He gets blamed for everything. Everything that the fairy world sort of conjures upon the family, Jared gets blamed for. And the series of five books is really, you know, slowly first Simon, then Mallory, and then finally their mom coming to terms with the fact that actually, like, the fairies are real and Jared is not just a total screw up. And the dad is not coming back, basically, like broad brushstrokes. Those are the narratives. But what we end up with is a lot of little challenges where we meet different kinds of creatures. Mm-hmm. There is a sameness to the creature adventures. Everything wants to kill them. The goblins want to kill them. The troll wants to kill them. The griffin doesn't want to kill them, but is dangerous nonetheless. Mm-hmm. There's just a lot of peril here that can feel a bit Monster of the Week.
Right. Yeah. And I can't remember. There was a recent episode that we did where you said it feels like every time we turn around, a different member of the friend group or the family is being captured and we have to go and rescue them. And I found the exact same thing here. I was like, okay, you know, when we encounter the elves, it's, oops, Simon might have to stay in this glade forever. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, we go to this other thing and it's, oops, Mallory got kidnapped and now we've got to rescue her from this glass coffin. So I appreciated that we were changing up the fae creatures, but particularly reading the books back to back to back, it really does have that sameness.
And in fairness to the book series, they come out 6 months apart originally. Okay. And I think if you were reading them at that pace, it probably would have been fine because you would have been excited for the next Monster of the Week. Whereas this way, it's a lot all at once. It's also worth noting that there is one sort of villain all the way through, which is the ogre Mulgarath, who is sort of controlling all of the bad fairies and wants this book that I haven't even mentioned the book, Joe. I haven't even mentioned the Spiderwick Chronicles.
Oh, we haven't even mentioned Arthur Spiderwick, aka the person to whom the series is named.
So Arthur Spiderwick is Aunt Lucy's dad. And of course, as you come to recognize over the series of the narrative, Aunt Lucy has been locked away in not just in a sort of generic institution. She's in a mental hospital and she's there because nobody believes her that the fairies are real and controlling her life and have stolen her father.
Yeah.
And the whole thing has started because Arthur made this field guide where he talks about all the different kinds of fae creatures, but also how like to best get rid of them. And so Mulgarath, who wants to destroy all the good fairy creatures and control the fairy world, wants the book. And so that's the central tension that exists throughout the narrative.
We should also note that Mulgarath's plan is very ill-defined in this. So every single fae creature is trying to get their hands on this book, and it's about, you know, Jared and his siblings trying to keep it away from them. But there's this pressing, ominous dread that the person you absolutely cannot let have the book is Mulgarath, because he will use it to destroy the world and become super powerful. And it's like, I'm sorry, how exactly is he going to do it? Just, it's not important.
No.
And ultimately, I don't think it really matters that much. But from an adult reader perspective, it was a little frustrating to be like, you just have to believe us. Mulgarath, bad. Don't let him get the book.
The ending is also like,
it's so big.
It's so big and also simultaneously so easy. Like basically what happens is they're having this big fight with Mulgarath, and Mulgarath is like throwing people out the window and they're like, he's destroying everything. And eventually Jared stabs him and he falls out a window and he turns into a bird to try to save himself. Mm-hmm. And Hogsqueal the Hobgoblin eats him. The end.
Because we learned that this hobgoblin really likes to eat birds and other small animals. So upon seeing the opportunity to get rid of this ogre that he's been trying to kill through, admittedly, the entire five books, he just gobbles him up and we're done.
It just seems like if the whole time Mulgarath the shapeshifter could have been eaten when he was in small creature form, someone should have thought of that before now. That's all I'm saying.
It's true. Yeah, it seems like until the Grace family arrived, nobody really had much ingenuity with how to deal with this guy.
Yeah. And then, of course, the emotional sort of story arc resolves because Helen recognizes that she was wrong. Helen's the mom. She was wrong to think that Jared was just a bad kid and realizes there's all this other stuff going on in his life. Jared realizes that he loves his mother and that the thing with his father leaving is not really his mother's whole fault. Mm-hmm. And they meet Arthur Spiderwick really briefly. He's been staying with the elves. And Lucinda gets to say goodbye to him properly before he disappears into dust. And the end.
Yeah, because we learn that he was actually abducted and sort of held for safekeeping by the elves for, I want to say, 60 years?
80 years, I think.
80 years in the book, 60 years in the movie.
Yeah, and this is another important thing that's going on. all the fairy creatures want to get the book, but it's not always clear which fairy creatures might be trustworthy with the book and which ones might not. Mm-hmm. So for instance, if the elves were to get the book, they would kind of hold it in suspended animation so Mulgrath couldn't get it. But it's hard for the kids to discern always, like, who are the good fae and who are the bad fae.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think a lot of the enjoyment comes not just from the various adventures, because even though we said there is a slight sameness to them, there's something fun about learning the details of interacting with a different fae and what their strengths and their weaknesses are and how is the family going to get out of it. I like that more often than not, it's not action-based. It's actually Jared or Simon or Mallory using one of their skills, be it fencing, be it Jared's ability to quickly think of a solution and, you know, almost use wordplay to get themselves mm-hmm. out of situations. So I really liked the fact that it wasn't, oh, okay, we've got to do spells, we've got to use a sword or something. Like, it's much more thinking heavy than not.
Yeah, we have three really smart kids here who are smart in different kinds of ways. And basically, you know, the lesson here is that they all have to learn how to work with each other's kinds of intelligence in order to achieve mm-hmm. what they want to achieve. And like, that's a nice message. I liked that.
Yeah.
The other thing that I liked is this exploration of the world not believing you.
Mm.
There's always some of that in these kinds of books that have fantasy elements in the real world. But like, Jared gets expelled from school over the fact that he's like fighting fae creatures in the hallway and like...
Yeah, bringing a knife to school.
Yeah. And there's something really effective about the emotional weight of Jared's mother not believing him as all of this is going on. Like, I actually thought that exploration was quite mature considering the pitch of the books otherwise. Mm-hmm. And I think it made it a bit more complicated and interesting to me than it would have been otherwise.
Yeah, I also like that even as we have to spend a little bit of time convincing first Simon and then Mallory that these things are real, it also doesn't take the entirety of the story. Like, yes. We really just keep Helen, the mom, on the sidelines for most of the adventures. But on the flip side, one thing that did frustrate me was that it felt like at the start of each of the five books, we had to hit a soft reset where the kids were fighting with each other again. It felt like a lot of the progress we had made from the previous book or books had been put to the side, and we needed to spend a couple of chapters getting back to a place where we agree we're going to work together. And again, I think that was harmed by reading them in quick succession, but it did make for a slightly frustrating experience.
I have to say, this is one of the weirdest, like, published volumes I've encountered, Joe, because I don't know if yours was like this. I think we had the same.
It was like the size of a brick.
It was the size of a brick, but like, it wasn't paginated as a whole.
No.
It was literally like someone had taken the covers off the individual books and like stuck them all together. So you had all the maps repeated over and over again. You had the same acknowledgments repeated over and over again. You had.
Yep.
And that was a really weird experience because.
Truly.
I mean, yes, we had this thing where we're reading separate books as a single volume and maybe they were trying to break that up for us, but I just got like, I would get to the end of one and be like, okay, well, let me flip through like 25 pages to find where the next one actually starts again. And like, yeah, I just found that supremely irritating.
Yeah, it definitely seemed like one of those things where people just didn't care enough when we were putting together this tabulated volume. Because I had a similar issue where I just kept getting a little bit annoyed by it. You know, I actually didn't mind the repeating of the map because it felt like sometimes we went to a different place than we had, like, we'd never been here before. But, you know, the fake letter from the kids to the authors about, hey, these are our stories, please tell them in book form. I was like, I don't need to keep reading this.
Well, and also I kind of felt like it was a missed opportunity to include some extra stuff, like those many pages that are spent repeating that content that nobody's going to read more than once, like the introductory letter, you don't need to read that over again.
No,
we could have had, I don't know, like a sample of Beyond the Spiderwick Chronicles or like I don't know, anything.
Yeah.
Like, normally when you have a compendium volume like this, you get a little bit of extra stuff, and this was like aggressively not that.
No, it was aggressively the same thing over and over again.
It really was. It was so weird.
So before we leave the book behind, did you have any comments about the illustrations? Because this included quite a number of them. I thought we were only going to get them maybe at the start of a chapter, but it felt like maybe every 2 to 3 pages, we were often getting nearly a full page spread.
Yeah, I think the illustrations are part of what make the book feel quite old timey and like a bit of like an English adventure story. I definitely had that kind of vibe. I liked them. I think they added a lot.
Right.
I did come to appreciate that the captions under the images were often a little bit cheeky or a little bit funny. I appreciated that. Part of me just wondered if this should have been a graphic novel, though. I'm pretty sure it's Tony DiTerlizzi who's doing the illustrations. And I wondered if like more integration would have been better. I don't know. But they do add a lot. They certainly help you imagine the characters. And obviously, the film takes a lot of inspiration from those images, too.
Yeah. That was the big thing, because I think you had a head start on this. So you had messaged me a little bit about, it's possible to write goblins without being racist and other fun sort of winks at She Who Must Not Be Named. But you're not wrong. This definitely has Harry Potter vibes. It has a little bit of Narnia vibes. But the thing that sets it apart really are these fae creatures, even though many of them are familiar. Like we've encountered brownies before. We've encountered goblins. We've encountered elves and all these kinds of things, even griffins, right? Mm-hmm. But I think the illustrations helped me to make them a little bit unique, because they often had a different look than I was used to seeing in other forms.
Yeah, I definitely think that there's something quite special, I think, about the way the Spiderwick Chronicles deals with these characters. Like, I never felt like, oh, great, another troll under a bridge, because there was something unique about it. And I think you're probably right that the illustrations lend a lot to that.
Yeah. I was particularly fond of the look of the dragons, because I feel like we often see one particular look for them. Mm-hmm. And these ones were very thin and almost like a flag, the way that they would wave through the air. There's this one image where the mother dragon tries to go after the griffin, and we see them entwined together the illustration. I thought it was really captivating.
I agree with you. I really appreciated how almost like serpentine they seem. Yeah. And I guess it's obvious that there's like a relationship between dragons and snakes, but you're right that I think in pop culture especially, we've moved into the era of like the cute dragon, right? Like,
right,
you know, a How to Train Your Dragon kind of round, stuffy, cuddly kind of dragons, and seeing them represented back in this sort of snake-like way, it made them really creepy. And it also made it clear that the dragons were like not on the good guy's side and the griffin was, which is another different vibe. You know, I think we're used to dragons as either helpers or neutral in more recent sort of pop fantasy. So that was cool, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, why don't we shift over to the film?
Let's do it.
The last place Jared Grace wanted to be.
I know this house isn't perfect,
but we can make it work.
Was stuck here.
Oh, the house. Yeah, it's great. You like big, creepy houses in the middle of nowhere.
Stop acting like a jerk.
But like any old house,
check it out.
This one has its secrets.
Don't you want to know where this thing goes?
Not really.
Do not dare to read this book. Arthur Spiderwick's Field Guide.
Dear reader, you will soon see that there are fantastical creatures living among us.
Why can't I see you?
You don't see us. Now you do. But only if we want you to.
But be forewarned. A rare few are, quite frankly, to be feared.
Ah! You took the book! I put a note right on the cover! Can't you read?
All around us, goblins, trolls, sprites. You gotta believe me.
Impossible.
You're such a liar!
Keep the book safe from the ogre.
Ogre?
Give me the book!
You're surrounded by goblins!
There's no such thing as
goblins! Now you believe me?
All right. So obviously we programmed this episode because there is a Roku TV series coming out shortly. Maybe we'll comment on it. We're not sure. They didn't send us screeners in time, so
we can leave that in.
Yeah, probably. Because you know what? I'm annoyed. We made the request like a month ago.
Yeah, we did. And the show comes out really soon. Yeah. And I think maybe we could talk a little bit about the production of that series, Joe, but there's something interesting going on there because Disney made the whole thing and then didn't air it. So I have questions. But anyway.
Yeah. Welcome back to Streamer Wars, where we make products. We don't like it. We sell it off to somebody else and hopefully it gets picked up, which I think is excitingly the case here because, we have a film adaptation from 2008. And this is directed by frequent director on the pod, Brenna, Mark Water. So we previously talked about him on Mean Girls, as well as the Vampire Academy film.
Okay.
And then I was actually very fascinated by the screenplay. So we have three different writers. We have Carrie Kirkpatrick, who is responsible for things like The Rescuers Down Under, Over the Hedge, as well as the live action version of Charlotte's Web.
Oh, so very kid stuff.
Yeah. And then we have David Barenbaum, who was responsible for the Will Ferrell Elf movie.
Oh, okay.
And then finally, we have John Sayles, who is, I gathered, also a bit of a director in his own right. But one of his most famous works is potentially a future episode for us, The Secret of Rowan Inish.
Oh, okay. Let's arrange you three writers.
Yeah. And the funny thing is that I went into this mistakenly believing that this was not a well-regarded adaptation. So I thought that, you know, this was like a lot of the other sci-fi fantasy titles that we have covered where they have a beloved book and then they make for a slightly garish Hollywood adaptation. And this one actually got decent marks. You know, it was expensive. It was $90 million in 2008. It ended up grossing $162.4 million, so it did okay, but not well enough to garner additional sequels. And in reality, the film wraps itself up very nicely. I don't know if this was ever even intended to be a franchise starter.
Yeah, I agree. It doesn't feel like it. You don't feel like you've ended the movie waiting for more, but by the same token, the series, I think, is also quite well contained.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. The five books feel like one complete story, even though, as you mentioned, there are alternative texts that explore the world in greater detail.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so let me run you through the cast and then we can talk about some of the differences. So we have Freddie Highmore as both Jared and Simon, and he was one of the things that critics really pointed out as a highlight of the film. So they felt that he did a very good job of distinguishing between the two characters.
Hmm.
You sound like you disagree.
I really liked him as Jared.
Okay.
I didn't find Simon to be a very persuasive character. Like, he basically might as well have not been there for most of the movie, as far as I was concerned.
I found that less to be an acting issue and more a screenplay issue. It feels like Simon is just not vital to this film.
Well, they almost always end up in situations in the film adaptation where it's Jared and Mallory working to save Simon. That's pretty much the dynamic that emerges. And it makes poor Simon not really a thing.
No, this is true. So you mentioned Mallory. We do have Sarah Bolger as the elder Grace child. But we should note that neither Freddie Highmore or Sarah Bolger are from the United States. So Freddie Highmore is British and Sarah Bolger is Irish.
And as you noted in your text to me, Joe, Freddie Highmore doesn't always hold the accent quite perfectly.
He's working on it. I mean, here's the thing. We have discussed him previously because he was Charlie in the Johnny Depp version of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. I mean, here's the thing. I've seen this guy in a ton of things. I actually think he's a very, very good actor. He's not bad in this, but he is quite young.
Oh, yeah. No, you can tell it's an early role for him. And honestly, it's a hugely demanding role. Like, he's playing two of the three lead characters. So, you know, if there are some stumbles. As I say, it didn't 100% work for me. I would have rather they just cast twins in the twin role, but, you know.
Wow. Yeah. And then give both twins something to do for a change.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Continuing down the line, we have Mary Louise Parker as their mother, Helen.
Love her.
Yeah, she's great. Of course, she's a mom, so she doesn't get anything interesting to do in this film. We have Andrew McCarthy as Richard Grace, that is the absent father. In this film, we saddle him with an infidelity storyline.
Yeah. He's not just absent here. He's like actually the villain.
Yeah, which, you know, I do think is a little bit satisfying when we do the bait and switch, because we learn that Mulgrath can transform into human beings as well for the film. So in this case, he impersonates Richard, and there's a big emotional climax where Jared has to say, "You're not my father." And he even stabs him. And I turned to Brian and said, "Wow, that was risky. I'm glad he was very certain that that was his father, or that was not his father, rather."
It's a very Freudian moment, to be honest.
Truly, truly that. Yeah. "You're not my father." Stab. Okay. Rounding out the humans, we have Joan Plowright as Lucinda Spiderwick. And then we have her father, played by David Strathairn, as Arthur. And yeah, you know what? I like Plowright as Lucinda. Mm-hmm. I kind of wish that she had gotten a little bit more to do. And I found David Strathairn just a very curious choice, because in some ways he does have the gravitas to play this elder man who's, you know, a field scientist and more or less the author of everyone's destruction. But I was unmoved completely by the reunion of these two characters at the end.
Well, it's interesting, too, because they sort of change the stakes. As we said, at the end of the book, Arthur literally turns to dust. And
because he's so old.
Yeah. Oh, because that's the thing. He's been held for so many years that, like, he can't possibly exist in the world. And so Lucinda sees him again only to say goodbye to him. And that's quite touching. It's a very emotional scene.
Yes.
In the film, they decide to give it a happier ending. And so I mean, they kill off Lucinda, basically, but, like, Lucinda goes to, like, live in suspended animation in the Elvish kingdom with her father, and I didn't love that choice. It, to me, the emotional heart is in that farewell, and we don't get it.
Well, and it's also a recognition that death exists, right? Like, the film really wants to play with kid gloves, that even though people do get relatively harmed, like Simon's leg gets really badly mauled by goblins at one point, which I think also is a way to write him out of the script a little. Oh, well, he can't come on adventures. His leg hurts. But yeah, it definitely feels like, oh, well, we need to have a happy ending for this film. So we're just going to regress Lucinda back down to age 6. And then we're going to, throw her to the dandelion puff slint things that just abscond with people and keep them in suspended. Like, I'm sorry, that's horrifying. Living in a frickin' field for 80 years is not my idea of, ooh, that's happy.
And thinking only 5 minutes has passed, right? Like, that's the thing. They're literally regressing Lucinda as if nothing in her life has mattered since her father left, and then disappearing her.
Yeah.
Which is kind of cruel since she's been locked up in an institution for 60 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're meant to read it as happy because she's reunited with her father. But honestly, take a beat and think about it. This ending is horrifying.
It's very, very bleak. Yeah, interesting. And as I say, it does not have nearly the emotional resonance as that big farewell in the book.
No, they're trying and it just doesn't work.
No.
No. So we do have a couple more people. We have voice talents for some of these creatures. So we have Seth Rogen as Hogsqueal. We have Martin Short as Thimbletack. We have Ron Perlman as what I gathered is a new creation for the film, Redcap, who is Mulgrath's right-hand man. He's the most notable of the goblins with the hat. Mm-hmm. And then we also have Nick Nolte doing the voice of Mulgrath. And I think it's pretty good. I think actually all of these vocal performances, they're good, but they're not showy. So, you know, I recognize the voices, but I actually had to look them up because I wasn't sure who it was.
Yeah, I had the same experience. Like when I sort of pulled up the Wikipedia about halfway through the film and was looking, I was like, Seth Rogen, is it? And then I had to listen to Hogsqueal again to hear Seth Rogen. And I really appreciated that, because ever since we entered the era of the celebrity voiceover, voice acting itself is an art.
It is. And people don't want to treat it that way.
No, they don't. They just want to put a celebrity in the role and be like, good. But I think both Seth Rogen and Martin Short, and honestly, Ron Perlman too, but his role is much smaller.
Yeah.
They do a great job at just being the character and not being like, Seth Rogen does Hobgoblin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly that. So some of the key distinctions between the book and the film, we talked about the ending, but we should note that, and this is one of the big criticisms for fans of the book, is that we basically take all five books, cram them into a single film. But the reality is that we're not touching book four at all.
No.
And we're barely addressing the issues in like books one, two, three, and five. Like, this is a very streamlined narrative. So we don't have any elves. We don't have any dwarves. We don't have any dragons. There's no Fuka and there's no Mulgrath Castle.
Yeah, it's basically the children versus the goblins from very early in the story. And Mulgrath is more like a head goblin than he is like a puppet master creature.
Yeah. So something else that's different is that the film introduces a protective circle around the house. So the house ends up becoming more of a fixture where we have to keep the circle in place or stay within it. And then when it finally starts to get breached, we have to protect the house. And for that, we use, this is the most perplexing addition I've found, we're using tomato sauce.
Okay, was that ever explained? Because it was one of those movies where I was like, did I black out and they explained why this is helpful? I no, don't understand.
It's literally just we created this thing where we read from the book and it says, oh, goblins can be destroyed or they're susceptible to like tomato sauce.
It's very weird.
It is very weird. I will say, though, the amount of satisfaction I got when the house is finally breached and they end up getting trapped in the kitchen and we just throw all of this tomato sauce in the oven and then set it on fire so it explodes everywhere. I thought it was a great sequence.
In general, I think the visual effects are great. The melting goblins work really well. And yeah, you're right. It's just that you really have to suspend your disbelief. And luckily you have by that point. It's the early scene where they're like making tomato sauce and you're like,
wait, what?
What is happening? I don't know. I think there's a lot of that in the film because they're trying to compress five books of lore into one pretty short film.
Yeah, I thought this was going to be longer considering.
Yeah, so you end up with a lot of requirements to just be like, yeah, okay. Like, I'm just going to accept that this is the rules of the world.
Yeah.
And it's fine. It's immensely watchable. It's very charming. It doesn't have the depth of the Fae universe that the books have, but they were never going to be able to stretch those books to five films anyway. So, like, what do you want?
Absolutely. And I think this is just you and I coming to this property very late and not having either the nostalgia or the invested interest in it. But fair. I looked at the complaints and I thought, well, that was never going to happen. I'm sorry. Like, this adaptation was never going to do that.
No, I agree completely, obviously. And I think it's a good argument, like an excellent argument for a miniseries. And I hope that the miniseries, I mean, not that we would know, but I hope that the miniseries does it justice.
The funny thing is, folks, is that by the time you hear this, we probably will have received screeners and I probably will have done something with it because I owe it to them. But Brenna, this is a fantasy movie with a relatively high budget. And when you look at the Wikipedia page, the number one thing that they talk about in terms of the production is what it was like to act against the green screen. So I would like to hear from you, hater of all things CGI. How did you feel about that?
Yeah, honestly, I didn't hate it in this
movie. Me neither.
I felt like it was pretty persuasively done. I think that, you know, there's a couple of things that are working in its favor. Number one, nobody expects a goblin to look like real life, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't have an image in my mind of like ideal goblinness. Mm-hmm. So I think that helps. I also think like the use of fencing as a core set piece is both charming in the book because it makes Mallory interesting.
Sure.
But useful in the film because it means they're never actually putting their hands on goblins. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that that actually really, really helps. No, I was surprised. I will be honest. I fully expected when the goblins started showing up to be like, oh, Joe's going to be annoying, so I'm going to hate this. And I did not hate it.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about the look of them when we were talking about the book. It is very distinct. They look kind of like toads.
Frogs. Yeah.
Yeah, they're very amphibious. And it translates so well into the visual medium. Like,
so much better than if they were humanoid, right? Like, so much better.
Yeah. Like, you know, we mentioned the Ron Perlman character, Red Cap, and that's kind of the closest we get. He almost has a look of an amphibious pirate.
Yeah, he does.
And it was distinct, but I just thought that these things had so much character. So even when they were congregating in large groups, it felt visually distinct enough that it wasn't, you know, okay, it's not Lord of the Rings, but it's also not, oh my gosh, my eyes are bleeding CGI monstrosity. Like, there's a good amount of character, and it doesn't feel of this world, but I liked that because I felt like it worked, particularly since the film and the book are doing so much with, you can't see this world unless you're wearing the weird eye patch or a hobgoblin spits in your face.
I do like that bit. Also, Joe, shout out to the Canadian Olympic fencing team for training up Sarah Boulder, because she does a great job.
I love that detail. I thought that was super funny. I actually found her performance very convincing. I liked Mallory more in the film than I did in the book.
Oh, so much more. I think partly because, you know, the story being so streamlined means that we don't have all the tangents. And I don't think the tangents do Mallory any favors in the book, because we get halfway into character development with her often. Like, there's this boy she has a crush on in the book.
Oh my gosh, it goes nowhere.
And like, there's Mallory crying in the bathroom. Did the boy say something? Who could ever know? Because that ends up being a red herring. And it's like, you have all these moments of like, oh, she's going to become a whole person. Oh no, she's not.
Yeah.
Whereas in the film, I found her very persuasive.
Absolutely. I'm most interested to check out the TV show to see if we do include the dwarves, because that's sort of... Admittedly, Mallory doesn't have as much to do because she's the damsel in distress who we quite literally have to rescue from a Sleeping Beauty-style glass coffin. Or maybe that's
it's
Snow White.
It's Snow White.
There we go.
Because of the dwarves.
Oh, right. Yes. But I'm really interested to see how they will be captured visually and what that space will look like, because of course it's subterranean, but they have a penchant for building things out of steel. So they've got steel dogs, they've got a steel tree, and
those will be cool.
I really want to see what that looks like visualized.
I really hope they do those as practical effects, because I think that that could be very cool if they are actually like physically robots.
Yeah. Well, that is my biggest fear, I'm not going to lie, is that I think we're talking about how this film dodged a CGI monstrosity, and I'm concerned about whether the show will make a smart decision. We'll find out. I mean, the other reason to be excited about the TV show is because it's got Christian Slater in what I can only presume is the Arthur Spiderwick role.
Oh yeah, it must be, right?
I mean, because the only other significant male character is the dad. Either that, or we're having Mulgrath impersonate the dad for like large portions of the narrative. I don't know. I assume it's Spiderwick.
Yeah, I think that would make the most sense. Also, Joe, while we're shouting out the cinematography of this film and the look feel, because I think it is strong, we should note that that's Zooey Deschanel's dad.
It's
Caleb Deschanel,
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Did you see that? I think it was a Variety story this week where Zooey Deschanel was like, I'm not a Nepo baby. Nobody cares who the cinematographer is. It's like, okay, except that like all your dad's best friends were very powerful people in Hollywood, but okay.
Yeah, I mean, hypothetically, he worked on a movie or two that maybe have benefited you down the line. Because
don't you think? And both you and your sister are very, very sought after actresses. Like, okay.
Here's the thing. Let's maybe be a little bit less defensive when people say, hey, you had a leg up, because the reality is you probably did. And you can just say, yes, I absolutely did. And then I made the most of it, because I still also have to be a decent actor, a likable person, good to work with, box office draw. Like, there's lots of ways to address it. But also, it feels like people genuinely don't know what nepotism means.
I do think, you know, and this is way off topic now, but it comes back to a conversation we've had a lot about privilege on the show. Like, people are so anxious about acknowledging that they have had privilege because they think it means that people are saying they're not deserving. And that's not what it means. Just saying like, hey, like maybe this aspect of things was a little bit easier for you. And like, you know, maybe feeling comfortable on film sets is actually like a pretty big advantage when you want to be an actor. Just a thought. Anyway. Yeah.
And maybe you could pay it forward in some way. If you had a little easier, try to make it easier for somebody else.
This is the thing, right? This is all anybody's looking for. But anyway, Caleb Deschanel, great work on this film. Your daughter says some things.
Yeah. I'll confess, I think the biggest surprise that I had was, I mean, I don't remember this movie coming out and making a splash. This is right around the time that I had stopped going to movies theatrically. I got a little bit... not jaded, but just
burnt out, Joe. You were burnt out.
Well, it was right after I had finished doing my master's and I was like midway through my PhD. So I had other things on my mind potentially, but I also, I don't think you and I had reconnected over our love of YA. So yeah, this wouldn't have been really on my radar, but it's so weird to me. Like, I fully went into this prepared to hate this, thinking that it was just, it was middle grade meh book and then a not great adaptation. I really enjoyed both these texts.
Yeah, I really did too. Can I just note one funny thing about the Wikipedia page that has nothing to do with the movie itself?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you know how there's like always the see also section?
Yeah.
So the see also section for this isn't like children's fantasy film or like movies involving fairies. No, the see also list is one, lists of films featuring home invasions.
Oh God, okay.
And two, Jumanji.
Oh, no, Jumanji, I can definitely see. Mm-hmm.
Because there's monsters?
Well, it does actually involve a bunch of creatures sort of invading a house, but it's very much a borrowed time narrative where it's like you've got to get control of this thing and kind of like make your way through different levels before everything goes to hell.
Okay, I still feel like for only two item list of C also, it's a stretch.
It's a weird one because, when I was looking at the IMDb page earlier and its recommendations were things like Inkheart, the Brendan Fraser like book comes alive,
right? Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay, so that Jumanji I can definitely see. Home invasion, you're gonna end up with stuff like The Strangers.
Yeah, they are. The list is hilarious. It's like it's a lot of very scary films. Yeah. And then this one.
And then this one. Yes. Yeah. If you need a palate cleanser after watching something horrifying, come and watch this, where the horrifying thing is taking an elderly lady and locking her in suspended animation for the rest of her life.
I mean, I don't know about you, Joe, but the whole time I was watching this, I was thinking to myself, this is a lot like Dial M for Murder.
Truly. Truly. The comparisons. So many.
Should we try bingoing this up?
Let's try.
Bingo!
Not a good bingo.
So I was looking at the board earlier, and I think this is going to be a colossal flop.
Yeah, I do too, but let's try.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm going to try to make an argument for abuse.
Okay. Of Lucinda?
I wasn't even thinking of that, but like, yes, like Lucinda's caregivers are cruel. Even if you do think she's living in a fantasy land, you don't have to like constantly disabuse her of her notions. But but I actually think like the way Jared is treated at school and sometimes at home is a little borderline abusive.
Yeah. I mean, there's a difference between disbelieving your children or thinking that they're slightly prone to being bad. But there are times where you just think, oh, Helen, you are not on your child's side. Like, who is advocating for this 9-year-old?
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's like there are moments in the book where you're like, this kid isn't 17 and setting fire to cars. Like, even if all of this is made up, this kid needs help, not you being a butt. But anyway, she's got a lot going on.
Truly.
Obviously, magic supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
We have a dead body in the book because Arthur's allowed to die in the book.
No, I'm going to say no to this because when we use dead body, it's like a dead body that's driving the narrative. And we know that he is alive throughout the entire book.
Fine. We have a road trip in the book.
Truly.
Then we don't have one in the film, but because they truncate everything. But we do have one in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And borrowed time, obviously, because they have to figure this whole thing out before Mulgarath gets the book.
Truly. Yes. And in the film, that's even more expedited because we got to do it before the protective spell gets broken.
Right. Which weirdly turns salt into mushrooms. I still don't understand the visual choice there.
I do not understand it. We do have a female writer.
Oh, right. Yes, absolutely.
Because it's an action film, of course we have montage.
So much goblin montage.
Yeah, and then people can question this, but I'm going to say Mary Louise Parker is a pretty established actress in her own right. So I think when you say we need a mom figure and you cast her, I mean, you're technically casting Hot Mom, but it's still Mary Louise Parker. And I feel like people know who she is.
I agree with you. And I also think Nick Nolte as Mulgrave is a pretty big stunt cast.
Sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. almost wish, you know, if we could redo this again, you could do Jack Black and then he could do his voice performance from the Super Mario Brothers from Mulgrath.
That would be a choice.
It'd be a different. Okay, so that is nowhere near a line. This is actually one of the worst performances we've had on Bingo in quite some time.
Okay, but I am going to make a CanCon argument for the Canadian Olympic fencing team.
You know what? I'll give it to you.
It still doesn't make a line.
Still not a line.
Yeah, it's so funny. I wonder if this is the difference between working in a children's text versus a YA, because obviously if there had been a sexual awakening in this film, that would have been really disturbing.
Yeah, I mean, the book starts to go there because Mallory is clearly infatuated. Yeah, but it just doesn't turn into anything, so.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Okay.
Yeah, so we're really changing gears for next week's episode, Joe, I gotta tell you.
Hmm. Yeah. Brenna, for the first time ever, we're going to veer into documentary.
Yeah, I'm sort of excited for this one. So we're going to take a look at Girl State, which is a new Apple TV documentary just recently out. People might be familiar with Boy State, which was quite popular, about young boys learning about the democratic process through this like camp system sponsored by the American Legion. This is the flip side version. This is the girls' version of that.
Yeah, I'd never heard of Boy State until this new film was coming out and people immediately drew comparisons. So I think you've seen Boy State, I have not. So I'm going to watch both of them so that we can have a bit of a conversation, because very obviously, even from title alone, we are focusing on gender.
Yeah, hugely so. And I'm really interested to hear what you think about both. Boy State was nominated for an Oscar, and ooh, I try to watch the Oscar docs every year, even if I never get to anything else.
Okay.
And so that's the reason why I saw it, and it bummed me out.
Oh, so, great.
I'm interested to hear what you think about it, and then to talk about the Girl State version.
Okay, fascinating. Yeah, so folks, come with us to Girls and Boy State.
It's going to be interesting. And then, Joe, I do have to tease this for our listeners, because I know that they've already seen us tease it on social media, but guess who's going back to John Green World? It's Joe, and he's so excited about it.
So excited. It's turtles all the way down. But in my level of excitement is only compounded by the fact that I think we've nearly run out of John Green titles. So is this the last one I'll ever have to do?
This is probably the last one you'll ever have to do, because he's not really writing YA anymore. He's moved into nonfiction. So,
right.
Yeah. So I'm excited for this one. I loved the book when I read it a million years ago. So I'm excited for the reread and to check out the film.
Okay. Yeah.
So if you want to write in to us about the Spider-Man Chronicles or Girl State or anything you've heard us talk about on the show, you can find us on social media at HKHSPod or on the hashtag HKHSPod. Joe, where do they find you?
I can be reached at B Stole My Remote, and that's the letter B.
And I'm at Brenna C. Gray, that's Gray with an A. And for anything more long form or to get into our mailbag, you can write to hkhspod@gmail.com.
Mm-hmm.
This was fun, Joe. I was like fun. Very skeptical when you programmed it, but I'm 100%. Glad we did it.
Yep. This is one of those things where it's good to remain open-minded, because I think we both went into this trepidatious. We ended up having a good time.
It's true. It's true. All right. Well, thanks, everybody. And until next time, I will see you on the page.
And I will see you on the screen.
Yeah, I agree with you. They're very... Sorry.
You're fine.
No, I'm not.
I think this also lends a little bit of credence to why we felt like this has a bit of a British flair to it. Like, Freddie Highmore and Sarah Bulger are both UK actors.
You should retake that, because Sarah Bulger is Irish.
I was going to say, she's definitely not. We do have a female writer.
Oh, right. Yes, absolutely. And one of the screenwriters too, right?
No.
Oh, okay.
They're all men.
Okay.
Carrie with a K. No. Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Okay.